There are a number of sources that you can find of Jews who felt that it was okay to look at the opinions of non-kosher Jews about the Bible and non-Jews about the Bible and use them if they appeal to you intellectually.
Then we have disputes in the Talmud between meaning.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Very good.
Yes. So it's okay for the rabbis who are very knowledgeable, but it's when I go to a book in the library and I see a book about the Bible, should I pull it out and see how knowledgeable the person was or how religious that person was before I feel comfortable going into it? The rabbis, sure, they can study everything. They have such a knowledge base. We're talking about the interested Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a different story? Should I be more concerned about the author of the book and his observances, or should I be more concerned about what his knowledge base is? Me as a regular person, not as a person who has comprehensive.
If you are pulling books off of the shelf with saying, I am going to agree with everything that is written here, then of course you shouldn't. But if you are planning on reading critically and taking from here and taking from there, then I don't see a problem with it.
We're also assuming that this is not altering our halakhic thing.
Right.
Halakhic thing we get from halakhic sources.
Right. That's right. One comment on this I wanted to make. I once heard a speech by Professor Michael Rosenach from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, a brilliant professor of Jewish education, and he mentioned Nachama Leibovich in his talk, and somebody in the question period said, "Who is this person?" They didn't know who Nechama was, so I gave this like 30-second definition. I'd studied with Nechama Leibovich. I had the schut of studying with her for a couple of years in her dining room in small groups. But I thought that Mike Rosenach summed up what Nechama Leibovich does better than I had figured out in my years. He said that one of the things that she does, she knows that people have the tendency to be critical of the things that they read, and she doesn't want that students will be critical of what's written in the Bible, and so she sets up the commentators in such a way that you are always choosing between them. You're criticizing Rashi, and you're criticizing Rabban, and you're criticizing Ibn Ezra. You're choosing and saying which one of these interpretations appeals to you more, and and she allowed people this to do modern kind of reading of texts while not doing dismissive critical readings of the Bible. The Bible remained the holy text, but she was encouraging students that when you read through commentaries like Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, and Ramban, that you pick and choose between them. So there are people who pick up Rashi in particular, but sometimes even Ramban, less true about Rashbam and Ibn Ezra, but there are people who pick up Rashi and Ramban and say, Of course, I am going to agree with this. Yesterday at the B'nai Torah, there was a shiur going on. There was a guest lecturer giving a shiur, and he offered an interpretation of a Talmudic text that he had given out to everybody. And somebody said that she didn't like the interpretation. There was a whole discussion developed between, and somebody pulled the Talmud off the shelf, and they opened up Rashi's interpretation. And Rashi interpreted the way the lecturer had interpreted. And kol hakavod to the lecturer. I should give kavod to the person who did this. Rabbi Shlomo Brown, who used to be the menahel of the Opana here in Toronto. He was visiting for Shabbat, and he gave this shiur, and somebody supported his reading of the Talmudic text with Rashi, and he said, but that doesn't mean that this person who offered a different interpretation is wrong. You know, that does not close the discussion. Now that we've seen that Rashi interpreted it the way that I interpreted it, there's still her interpretation of the text is also something worthy of consideration. It was very nice so it depends how you're pulling the book off the shelf. If you're pulling it off the shelf with the feeling I am going to follow everything there, then of course you have to look about the bona fides of the religious bona fides of the person that you're reading. But I think that all of us anybody who's received a university education knows that you read critically. You read that you decide what you're going to accept and what you're not going to accept, and you can do that with Bible commentaries also.
Just a point yes. about those who accept the Rashbam halachically, and we do it by saying that the Rashbam, what the Rashbam is telling us is that Kodem Matan Torah, that was the way things are run. With the advent of Torah, it changes for Jews, but as mentioned before, not in respect to Korbanot, where mm-hmm. the Laila is Holy Chacharayot.
Okay. This can work for some of his examples. It can't work for other examples. So let me just give you a couple of other examples where it can't work. I hear what you're saying about that, but it's not going to work consistently. The next example... Again, Ibn Ezra got extremely angry at Rashbam when he found out that this was how Rashbam was interpreting the text, the famous text in the book of Shmot, Vayalacha lo'ot al yadcha lezikaron bein einecha l'man tiyeh Torat Hashem b'ficha ki biyad chazaka hotziyacha Hashem Yisrael. Rashbam writes, lo'ot al yadcha lefi omek pshuto, the deep shot, the deep understanding of the text here is, so I've said before, if you think the pshat means the interpretation that you come up with at first glance, forget about that. And if you think that pshat means the literal understanding of the words, forget about that too. Because now Rashbam is going to say the pshat meaning of this verse is that it should be understood as a metaphor. Pshat, the best definition, pshat is a very difficult term to define. The best definition of pshat that I ever heard was Nachama Leibovich's definition of pshat. She said, pshat ze ma she'ani omer, midrash ze ma she'acherim omerim. The pshat is what I say, midrash is what the other people say. She said that with a twinkle in her eye, of course. The best definition, serious definition of pshat is the interpretation that fits into the context. That sometimes you can take a verse out of its context and it has and you can give it a meaning that doesn't that fits the words but doesn't fit the context, but a pshat is an interpretation that fits the words and fits the context. So here's Rashbam's contextual interpretation of the verse, Vayalecha lo'ot al yadcha, Yelecha lezikaron tamid ki'ilu katuv al yadcha. It should be as if the Torah is written on your arms. And it should be as if the Torah is written on your head, between your eyes. The Torah, you should surround yourself with Torah. And it is like a verse, Simeni kachotam al libecha, when the lover says to the beloved in Shir HaShirim, Simeni kachotam al libecha, make me a locket on your heart. That doesn't mean do open heart surgery and install me on your heart. It means I should be so close to you as if I were a locket on your heart. Let's see if I can remember my high school English. The difference between a simile and a metaphor. Yes. So if there was a k, then it would be a simile. But Rashbam is saying that this is a metaphor as opposed to a. So you don't always have the k. It's as if you're surrounding yourself with this. As Ibn Ezra begins, lucky for us, wrote two commentaries on the book of Shmot. The shorter commentary, which isn't in the Mikra Kedolot, which he wrote when he was in Italy, and then he moved to northern France, before he moved to England, where he died, he moved to northern France, and there's excellent evidence that he met Rashbam. It's so hard to imagine that he didn't meet Rashbam. We know he writes about having met Rabbeinu Tam, and I assume he has to have met Rashbam. And anyways, he heard about Rashbam's interpretation of the text. And in his shorter commentary, his earlier commentary on Shmot, He does not say anything nasty about this interpretation, but after he moves to northern France, he writes, Yesh chokim al avotenu haktoshim. There are some people who disagree with our great rabbis and who have said that this verse is to be understood as a metaphor, and it is not to be understood as a metaphor. You can't understand the Torah as a metaphor. And most Jews thought that you could not offer metaphorical interpretations of biblical texts. And why do you not offer, if you are a Jew living in northern France in the 12th century, why do you not offer metaphorical interpretations of Torah texts? Because who is offering metaphorical interpretations? The Christians. The essence of Christian interpretation is based on taking all these things that seem that halakha says refer to laws and saying, oh, they're just metaphors. So when it says don't eat pig, it just means don't behave like a pig or something like that. It's not meant to be taken literally. Rashbam knew this. Rashbam argued on a very regular basis with the Christians in his area, and he knew that the standard Jewish approach was to avoid metaphorical interpretations of the Bible because it made it bad for our side in our arguments against the Christians if we admit that rules that look like they're talking about laws are actually to be understood metaphorically. And he wasn't afraid to do it here. On a verse that's extremely important, did Rashbam put on tefillin? The Hava Amina that he didn't put on tefillin is unthinkable that he didn't put on tefillin. Although there is...
Maybe it was conflicted.
There is a great joke. Pardon me for telling yet another joke that's not on television. There is a great joke about the two yeshiva boys who met each other about 20 years after they left yeshiva, and one of them's got a kippah on his head and the other one... Nebuch doesn't have a kippah on his head anymore, and the religious one sees the other one and he says to him, what happened to you? He said, you know, things happen over there. He said, do you still keep Shabbos at least? He says, not really. He says, just kashrus, do you still keep sort of not the way I did back in yeshiva. He said, tefillin, do you still put on tefillin? And he says, I put on Rashbam's tefillin instead of Rashi or Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, the metaphorical tefillin. But Rashbam would not have liked that joke because Rashbam felt that a Jew ought to be putting on physical tefillin. But what's the meaning of this? There's some people who say, again, some people have said that Rashbam says this only about the verse in Shmot and doesn't say it. Usually our source for the halakha is the verse in Dvarim for tefillin, and he does not say this in the verse in Dvarim, and that is possible. Okay, so these are two kind of surprising interpretations of Rashbam.
Can I just justify that? If you pursue tefillin in the Talmud, you see that everything is halakha l'moshe misina. The picture of the tefillin,
right,
where you do things. So it would be no surprise to say that fundamentally it's really the oral law that has passed tefillin down in the form that we have.
Okay.
Rather than...
Very good. And to say that it's not based on a verse. Okay, fine. All of those things work, except now I'm going to give you some examples that just don't work. And The best example that I have here, it's not the only example. I'll mention a couple of other examples. The best example I have here is on page 4, where you have the verses in Parshat Mishpatim that talk about a shomer. If you are watching something for somebody else, somebody gives you his tape recorder to watch it on his or her behalf. What is your responsibility as a shomer? So the verses say, so verses 6 and 7 say, if somebody gives me something to watch and I'm watching it and it's stolen, so if we catch the thief, that's fine. If we didn't catch the thief, it's stolen. Somebody gave me something to watch. It was stolen, and then we couldn't find the thief and couldn't find the item. What do? I go and I swear that I didn't steal it. I was the... Bailey is the technical legal word for the person who's watching the item. I was the Bailey, and it was stolen from my possession. I swear that I didn't steal it, and that's it. I am not responsible to pay. That's what verses 6 and 7 say here. However, then you look at verses 9 and 10. If a man kitei nishar reyo chamor or shor or sevachol beimal lishmor umeto nishbar nishbar in roeh shuat Hashem tiyev en shneim im lo shalach yadov im lecha reyo v'lakach ba'alav lo yishalem im ganov yiganev mimo yishalem li ba'alav. But then in verse 9 I'm guarding something for my friend and it gets stolen, and then verse 11 says im ganov yiganev mimo yishalem li ba'alav. If it's stolen you have to pay for it. So, without looking at any commentaries or anything, what did we all learn in Mishnah? What is the difference between these two units of text? Verses 6, 7, and 8 are talking about what? And verses 9, 10, and 11 are talking about what? What's the distinction?
A jail thing versus an animal thing.
Oh! Here is somebody who knows how to read pshat. But let's go, we'll get back to you in 1 second. But what did we all learn in Mishnah? Shomer chinam and shomer sachar. It depends whether you're getting paid or you're not getting paid. If I'm getting paid to guard something and it gets stolen, then I am responsible according to halacha. Shomer sachar has to pay if he's getting paid, but if he's doing it for free, then he has no responsibility if it's stolen from him. That is the halakha. That's what the Mishnah says. That's what the Gemara says. That's what the Rambam says. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. That's what everybody says la halakha, except for Rashba. Well, the halakha, I guess he'd still say that, but he offers a different. He offers your interpretation. He looked at the words and he said, "Here's what the words say." You know, he'd been studying Mishnah and Gemara from the time that he was a little kid, and he knew that that's how he's supposed to read it. But he came there with new eyes. He looked at it. That's, you know, that's another thing that I don't see myself as being a creative person coming up with wildly different new interpretations of things that other people didn't see before. And this, one of the things that I really admire about Rashbam is this ability, you know, growing up in a community, not rebelling against the community, being part of the community, and still looking at things and seeing them in a very new way. So he looks at this verse and he reads it your way. He says, the beginning of the text is talking about guarding chattels, guarding money or a tape recorder. And the end of the text is talking about guarding an animal. And he says it makes sense that the distinction should be between guarding chattels and guarding an animal. What does he say here? Beparasha zo poter da shomer migneva vaveda, uparasha shniya mechaivo migneva vaveda. Verse 7 essentially says that if you were watching it and it was stolen from you, you're not responsible. Verse 11 says you are responsible. Pershu rabotino, rishon b'shomer chinam, shnia b'shomer sachar. And the rabbi said that the distinction is whether you're getting paid or not. Well, if he pshuto shel mikra, but what's the pshat? Parsha rishona shekaduv ba ki yitein yishareh ukezav ukelim lishmor metaltalin hein ulishomram betoch beitok yishar chavatav netanan lo lefichach im nignibu beito patur ki shemaran ki shmirat chavatav. Aval parasha shniya shekaduv ba ki yitein yishareh uchamor oshor oseh b'chol beimah lishmor v'derech beimot v'irob basadeh v'adai kshif kidam amanat lishomram mikanavim mifkidam lo v'lachein im nignibu chayav. Rashbam says, first of all, in reading the text, he explains it the way you do. And second of all, he says it makes sense. Because how do you guard a tape recorder? If somebody gives you something like this to guard, how do you guard it? You put it inside your house and you close the door. You lock the door when you leave the house. What does it mean to guard something? It means to guard it. If somebody gives you something to guard, the assumption is that you will guard it the same way that you guard the stuff that you own. And so if you give me your tape recorder to guard for you, and I put it beside my tape recorder at home, that's the way I guard my own tape recorder. And so if somebody breaks into my house and steals both our tape recorders, then I did my job. But if you give me your cow to guard, cows tend to wander around. They move, not quickly, but they do move to tend to wander around, and so you have to watch it more. And if you were not watching it and it got stolen, you have to hire, either you have to do the watching of the animals yourself, or you have to hire somebody to watch the animals. And so, now, you might say to me, before we give the possible solutions here, I'll just point out that how does the Mishnah in Hamafkid begin? It begins, Hamafkid, Eitzel Chaveiro, Behema, O Kelim. The Mishnah knows that there's a possibility. I'm arguing that can't prove this, but Mishnah knows that there's a possibility of saying that a different rule applies to chattels and to animals, and that's why the Mishnah begins a mafkid etzel chaveiro behema o kelim. The same rules apply whether you are watching chattels or you are watching an animal. And then the Gemara says, "Lavali lamidne behema, lavali lamidne kelim." Why do we have to? The simple answer is because there's another way of reading the text. The Rashbam's way of reading the text that they're not interested in. They want to say that the only distinction is whether you are watching it or not. There's a guest speaker who will be speaking at York University this afternoon. For those of you who have not had enough talks today, I could recommend Rabbi David Weiss Halivni. Professor David Weiss Halivni will be speaking at York University this afternoon. When I first met Professor Halivni many years ago, and he asked me what I was interested in, and I said Rashbam, he said, "Okay, let me ask you a question." And he said, "I've been trying to figure out Rashbam for years. What was Rashbam's attitude about the Kadosh Baruch Hu, about God? God gave a Torah where he wanted us to be posek halacha, that the distinction between a shomer who is responsible for theft and a shomer who isn't responsible for theft depends on whether he's getting a salary or not. But instead of that, he wrote in the Torah on the pshat level that the distinction is whether you're watching an animal or watching chattels. Why, in Rashbam's worldview, did the Kadosh Baruch Hu write the pshat in such a way that it reads to a different conclusion than the halacha?" Professor Halivni and I have been discussing this for at least 20 years. We've both written about it a little bit, and I don't think that either of us has really solved the question. I think it's a fantastic question. Why did the Torah write that? Rashbam says that the simple meaning of the word va'avado le'olam, about a slave who decides that he will remain a slave for beyond 7 years. Halakha says he's a slave for until the Yovel, until the Jubilee, and he says lefi apshat kol yimei chayav. The pshat is all of his life. Why did the Torah write? These are other examples that I have that I didn't put on this. Why did the Torah write about a Kohen? We have some Kohanim in the room here. You are a Kohen, are you not, Rabbi Cohen? Pardon me?
He tends to be.
He tends to be. Okay, very, very, very good. So, in the beginning of Parshat Emor, it says when a Kohen is allowed to go to a funeral, and it lists Kim Lishayro Akarov Elav Limo Laviv Livno Liviso Lachiv Balachotov Btulah Krovai Lav. And then the next verse says, so that's it lists his father, his mother, his brother, his sister, and his son, and his daughter. And then the next verse says, Lo Yitama Baal Be'amav Lehechalo. Rashbam says, you know what the pshat is? The pshat is that a Kohen is not allowed to go to his wife's funeral. The halakha is, not only the Kohen is allowed to go to his wife's funeral, but if the Kohen says, I do not want to go to my wife's funeral, I'm a Kohen, mitamin oto ba'al korcho, you pick him up and you put him in the cemetery. He has to go to his wife's funeral. He's not allowed to say. And Rashbam says that the pshat of the verse is that a Kohen does not go to his wife's funeral. Now, you know, so I've heard people try on the Abadola Olam to say, okay, so the Torah is trying to say that if you're a slave who's given up on your freedom, you should, it's as if, morally speaking, you should stay a slave all of your life, but we're going to let you off at the Yovel, but you're not going to be able to explain that about the Kohen and his wife. You're not going to be able to explain that about the different Baileys. It doesn't make sense to say that these are mutually exclusive readings of the text. Either you go to your wife's funeral, either it's usher to go to your wife's funeral, or it's a mitzvah to go to your wife's funeral. You can't have it both ways. And Rashbam really wants to have it both ways. And
that's always the, you know, the way I look at all the persons are when they interpret it in a way different way. Like, ein tachat ein, why do you say ein for ein? Only means money, and the Rosh Rabbah says, of course, there it does mean on the pshat level. So if they're saying really to pay money, that counts.
Right.
You deserve to. So even by white, perhaps you could say the level of closeness is much different. You're born related to your parents and your brothers and your sisters. But you're not born related
right.
to your wife. That comes much later
mm-hmm.
on in life.
Mm-hmm.
So there's sort of a dichotomy in the relationship between you and your wife, which mm-hmm. perhaps the Pshat and the Trush are getting at, which I haven't like totally figured out, but on some level.
Okay.
What the Rashbam says is actually Gemara in Yevamos, without pay test.
What?
Exactly what he says. Namely, that from the Torah or not, and rabbinically speaking, yes, and if you say it like a Mason Mitzvah, for love alone, that's an opinion in the Talmud. Yerushas the Baal is not from the Torah. But he has to matami anyway.
Right. Okay.
So they took Yossi HaKohen and they for pushed him.
Right.
But that's a rabbinic.
Right. Okay. So personally, I must say that I'm not convinced that all the ways of harmonizing Rashbam work all that well. But even I'll concede, let's say that they work. Rashbam doesn't bother to do the harmonizing. And doesn't feel that there's anything terrible about writing a book that describes the Bible coming to conclusions that are not the conclusions of halacha. And he doesn't see any difficulty in circulating a book like that and getting people to read it without doing this work of the harmonization. And so if the question is, do we as halachic Jews have to feel bound that we can only offer interpretations of biblical texts if they conform with the grain of tradition, with the direction of tradition, I say that I do not feel the obligation to do that, because I don't think that Rashbam felt the obligation to do so, and I think that there were other, perhaps not quite as bold as Rashbam over the years. I think that he was maybe the boldest of the great halachists who wrote commentaries on the Bible, but it shows that he did not feel that there's anything terrible about doing this. Yes,
I think he understood the Torah Sheval Peh, that the concept of the Torah Sheval Peh is just that.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a text, and then there's a perhaps a completely divergent interpretation
right.
that's passed on orally.
That's
and
right.
So it's, anybody who understands the nature of Torah Sheval Peh would realize a pshat's one thing and that's another.
Right. And so it is. There is no problem then in if we are talking about pshat and talking about the biblical text, in saying the widest variety of, maybe there is a limit to what you can say, but the limit is wider than is generally understood here in Toronto to be the limit of what a religious Jew can say about the Bible. I think the example of Rashbam proves this. Yes?
I'd just like to raise the possibility that Rashbam did not always sleep well. Okay? Whether we have this recorded or not, he may have sat on this days and weeks and months, and again said, well, I write this, and in a sweat, okay, he sat down and he wrote it, and he said, I will leave it, and we will let professors in the future wait the way I see it. So the Rashbam may not have done these things with
yes.
He saw things that squarely contradicted what appears to be the halacha. Felt he had to write it, then we don't know
mm-hmm.
what Rashbam.
I can't prove that you're wrong, and I entertain that possibility. I think that he enjoyed doing this. That's my image of Rashbam, is that he enjoyed doing it, just as some of us in this room occasionally enjoy saying things that we know that somebody's going to disagree with in the city of Toronto. That's, you know, that's I think that he was like that, and I'll tell you some other time. I'll go through a few of his texts where I think he's. I get the impression that he occasionally is looking for trouble. Yes, pardon me. Yes. I suggest a number of times in my little notes on this commentary that I see impishness here and there, and you know.
Yeah.
It may. Yes. Yep. He may.
Intellect.
Right.
Yeah. It's tough trouble, the bottom line is, he let it stand. So
Right, he did let it stand. That's right. Yes.
Let me dare to enter into the area that you and Professor Halivni have been debating. And I think the approach to the Rashbam is the following. The Talmud says that dini mamonot, the things of Yeshua, dini mamonot are ultimately rational. They're logical. You can figure them out by yourself. So all he's saying is, if you look at the pasuk, you see that differences are made. And then the Chachamim came along and tried to understand what would be different, what would be the basis for different levels of acceptance, understood acceptance, because you can make conditions to do it otherwise. But what is normally understood by people as responsibility? So he drew that. He said, Torah's drawing this picture of different levels of responsibility. Like Chacham came along and started assigning, well, this is the kind of thing that somebody would normally, unless specified otherwise, have this and this kind of degree of obligation. Conversely, something that's greater risk or more difficulty, usually, unless specified otherwise, that would be. For instance, they have a debate about Socher, they're not even sure. Socher, the other parasha, which is it like? Is it more like Shemek? No, it's more like Shemek. It's all rational. And that's the Rashbam's point. There's a rational point being made by the Torah. Mm-hmm. That's pshat. And then the Chacham took it and interpreted it at a legal level and tried to set definitions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did they know that it was interpreted differently before them? Are they changing it? You know, all of these are possibilities. That once upon a time, before the Chachamim came along, it was interpreted in a different way. There's a text that I like to teach. I don't have here that presents the precisely opposite kind of approach. The approach that we more likely hear these days is Rashbam. Another one of Rashbam's radical interpretations was the interpretation of the phrase Arami Oved Avi, which in the Haggadah we understand Arami to mean the Aramean Lavan, and Avi is my father Yaakov, and an Arami tried to kill my father. And Rashbam says that the Pshat, as you will find in most modern Bible translations, is very different. Arami Oved Avi means my father was a wandering Aramean. Meaning either Avram or Yaakov, depending on which one you'd like to say, that Oved is not a transitive verb, for those of you as old as me and remember what a transitive verb is. It's not that Arami was trying to hurt my father, but it's an adjective here. My father was a wandering Aramean. And he and various other people explicitly or implicitly criticized Rashi for suggesting that Arami Oved Avi means that Lavan was trying to kill my father. So Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, in his commentary on Rashi, comes to Rashi's defense. And he says, you know, I've read all these arguments of all these people who have studied grammar and are telling me that Oved it couldn't be a transitive verb. And, you know, I know that they say this, but I know that when Moshe was on Har Sinai, God told him that the meaning of the words Arami Oved Avi, that Arami means Lavan, and that Oved is a transitive verb here, although it isn't a transitive verb anywhere else in the Torah. In other words, when Moshe was on Har Sinai and received these words, he received the authoritative interpretation of these words, and we have to conform to this, and there is no room for somebody to come along and offer a new interpretation of the words. An amazing kind of understanding of interpretation. In other words, looking for pshat is not allowed. It's interesting because Mizrahi doesn't do this consistently. And he is interested in pshat.
Sinai, that's what I wanted.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. But it's just, I think he's just so bothered because we sit there at the Haggadah, at the Seder every year, and we say, Lavan Bikesh Lakorata Kol Shanamar Arami Oved Avi, and to have those words coming out of your mouth when Rashbam and Ibn Ezra and others point out that couldn't be the meaning of those words. Those words don't mean what we say in the Haggadah. That just bugs him. To sit at the Seder every year and say words that he thinks are not a correct interpretation of the biblical text, he finds difficult. Rashbam, I assume, also said at his Seder, Lavan Bikesh La Korat HaKol Shenemar Arami Oved Avi. I have no reason to think it would seem impossible for me to suggest that Rashbam suggested that we should change the what we say at the Haggadah. But he said, that still does not stop me from looking at the biblical text and coming up with new understandings of the biblical text that do not go along with the traditions.
That understanding might be an asmachta.
Oh yes, of course, it might just be. That's right. That's right. It might just be an asmachta. That's right. And yes, Rashbam was not big on asmachtas, but we could talk about that another time. I have even more radical texts here that I have not reached, and I apologize for not reaching them. But to try to begin them in the last 3 minutes does not make sense. Are there any more comments or questions at this point? Please. Okay.
It's interesting, in the 19th century, all the key parshanim in the West, and it seems that all the, even in the 20th century, towards me, I should talk a little bit, their whole approach to parshanim was to show how the parshanim stretch
were the same as each other, yes.
Which was probably a reaction to reform if it was a criticism and all that, which I just, any comments you might have, in the context of the time, and we know, the late Middle Ages, there weren't really a lot of parshanim in the West. 16th, 17th, 18th century, don't really find like Parshanut.
Right.
The
19th century. Yes. An excellent point. I think that part of the conservative nature of the community is because of seeing the problems of related to Reform Judaism, and it's based on the kind of circle the wagons kind of strategy. And personally, I don't think that it's a good strategy, and I think I've never been attracted to the commentaries of people like Hirsch or the Malbim who are trying to convince me that the Pshat and the Midrash are really the same as each other. And I've always been attracted to the intellectual honesty of Rashbam, saying that they aren't the same as each other. They reach different conclusions. But you are right that there was this kind of political decision.
With Hirsch, led the battle on the form, but I don't know what the Malbim or Thema or there were other parishioners or the Meshachafa and the Nitziv also.
Mm-hmm.
They're really finding the they're making a real view in the Pesukim that allude to the Midrash. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just sort of another.
Right.
I don't know if they are politically sort of a harsh thing to say in a sense.
Right. You see, I would argue that one of the reasons why I think that Rashbam was more radical than Ibn Ezra was because Ibn Ezra was trying to deal with the problem of the Karaites, because in many of the countries where Ibn Ezra lived during his life, he had to deal with Karaites. And so Ibn Ezra felt the obligation to try to defend the standard rabbinic interpretation of verses more than Rashbam did, because Rashbam lived in a community where there wasn't, the only opposition was the Christian opposition, and he spoke strongly against the Christian opposition to our reading of the text. And we live in a world right now where there are people who are reading the Bible in a way that is not easy to bring together with an approach of Torah mitzvot. And so there is something to be said for the position that says so we have to have a more restrictive kind of reading of the Bible. I just don't think that it's worked. I think that strategy has not worked, and I think that the more open intellectual strategy of actually admitting, as you know, Ibn Ezra occasionally admitted, here's a Karaite, he interpreted the verse, and taka, it's not a bad interpretation of the verse as long as it did not contradict the halakha.
If we bring it back to today and kind of the beginning of what I'm hearing is, or what you're suggesting is that a kind of modern Orthodox view is to take in and realize the Rashbam kind of commentary that there are differences in.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that, quote, less
right now in Toronto today, a less modern interpretation ignores Rashbam, doesn't read Rashbam?
In general, Rashbam is not a very read commentary. And over the years, there was only one super commentary, commentary on a commentary. You know, there are hundreds of super commentaries that have been written on Rashi, and there's only one super commentary that was written on Rashbam. And in the introduction to the super commentary, he says, I've heard people saying, why should I bother reading this commentary? You know, what do I gain from reading this? How is this going to make me a better Jew reading this commentary? I often suggest to people that if you're asked to speak like at Shalashudas at your shul and you have to give some kind of Dvar Torah, don't look at Rashbam. Rashbam is not trying to edify and to uplift. He is trying to interpret. He's trying to say what the words mean. I'll give you one example. Rashi has this fantastic, beautiful midrash that he quotes from the Midrashim about why when a slave decides he wants to stay a slave for more than 7 years, why you pierce his ear and why you do it beside the door. And you pierce his ear because his ear heard on Mount Sinai that he's supposed to be God's slave and not be somebody else's slave, and he didn't listen. And the door, why did he go to the door? Because the door is the place of freedom. Because when we left Egypt, we took the blood and we smeared it on the doors. And then Rashbam, I hope you'll pardon me for saying this, he sounds like a university professor. He says, you know why they do this with his ear at the door? Because the door, usually their houses were made out of stone. And it's extremely difficult to attach an ear to stone. But the doors were made out of wood. And so because of that, they do it to the wood. If you're trying to attach it, you can't attach an ear to stone, but you can attach it to wood. He's just, and I'm sure that he's doing that impishly. I don't think that he's doing that because he really did a study, an archaeological study. He said, you know, Rashi's looking to find significance and ideas and education, and I'm going to tell you what the words mean. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you what the words mean. And that's what he's trying to do. And so his commentary was ignored by most. I think the reason that the manuscripts got lost for so long is because nobody was reading it, not because somebody was trying to censor it, but because people did not find this a meaningful thing to do. I find it a meaningful thing to do. I'm interested. I plead guilty. I'm a university professor. I'm interested in what the words mean. I want to read those words of the Chumash, and I want to know what they mean. When I speak at Shalashudas, at my shul, I rarely will quote Rashbam because he's only telling me what the words mean. And he's not telling me how I should be living a life. Did Rashbam not feel that people should be uplifted and should be edified and should be educated? Of course he did. But he also felt that it was good to read the words of the Bible as they are actually written. Yes?
I don't want to be unfair to you, but I just happened to look at the last page.
Yes. So the radical text that I was planning on getting to and that I didn't get to suggests that there were rabbis of the Middle Ages who felt that the assumption that we now have today, that an Orthodox Jew has to believe that every word of the Torah was given to Moshe at Mount Sinai, that was not the assumption made by every Orthodox Jew in the Middle Ages. And maybe some other time I can provide you with my proofs of that. The documentary hypothesis becomes more complicated because there is actually the suggestion that things contradict each other. And to say that there are contradictions in the Torah is much more difficult. And I don't think that that is easily accommodatable with an Orthodox kind of approach. But the suggestion that the Hebrew Bible that the Torah was not a completed document when Moshe Rabbeinu died is something that a number of rabbis in medieval times held. And although Rashbam doesn't say it directly, on the last page here you see my arguments hinting that that's what Rashbam actually thought. And certainly Ibn Ezra thought that, and there were others like Rabbi Yudah Hasid also. There were a number of there's a Torah in Motion events where we heard Snare Lyman's explanation of what Rabbi Yudah Hasid thought, that the Torah had texts that were added to it after the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. So I think that there is room, and I think that it is I think that it is tactically foolish of orthodoxy today to say that you are out if you are unwilling to subscribe to the idea that every word was written the way that there's a code there, that every letter there, that there's I think that it's tactically foolish to do this. Barry Levy's recent book on the subject has also made that point. I think that it was not universally felt. Rambam, true. Rambam says it clearly, but certainly there were other Jews in the Middle Ages who did not feel the way that Rambam did, and I don't think that it's a wise decision of orthodoxy to claim that today.
Even the Rambam might be
I just want to, just in fairness of time.
Yes.
I'm happy to,
okay.
I just want people to
feel free to
talk. I want to thank Dr. Lester. I'll mention sort of this same approach. I'll also to do with English is hopefully
No, I won't be. That won't be about Rush Bow. Yeah, no. Yes, I have to.
Right.
Yes. Right. Right.